I was ranting so long there, I forgot where it was going.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu, a.k.a. Player One, because I'm the older sibling, so I'm Player One.
We're two friends and comedians taking on American politics and trying to keep each other sane in spite of it.
We're making an honest effort on both counts, but it's probably hopeless. But we'll keep doing the podcast.
We talk to people who do the hard work to reclaim and reinvent democracy, and who point out what's getting in the way of that.
The idea that, like, any political change we make has to be non-threatening to the identity of white men means that we stagnate our political system.
That's my friend Ijoma Oluwa, who's on the show to talk about her new book, Mediocre: The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America.
And she talks about what it was like having her first book, So You Want to Talk About Race, become a bestseller all over again after the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police.
She also had her house burned down and had to have a security protocol for her family after being swatted by white supremacists. So 2020's been, it's been long. Then we'll talk to comedian Sarah Silverman about dropping the shield of irony in comedy and in life.
That was massive. I knew there was racism, but I had no idea the scope of it and the depth of it and the roots of it.
Sarah talks with us about her new podcast, about how COVID-19 took the life of her friend and collaborator Adam Schlesinger, and how all artists are scumbags.
Are we artists? And are we scumbags?
We are dudes. It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Kamau. Happy, hey. What is this, a Wednesday?
I mean, we're actually recording this on a Tuesday.
Tuesday.
But I didn't know if you were, like, pretending we were recording
live. I honestly do not know what the day is. You know, it's funny. I should know today's Tuesday, because yesterday I did something that I feel guilty about. And I'm not sure if you're in the, you know, if you have the power to absolve me.
Probably not.
But let's see.
Let's give it a shot.
You know, Joss and I found an apartment in Brooklyn.
Yay!
It's great, exciting. We need to get furniture. We have to invest in it because now it's
is the rent? Is it like a pandemic rent that they're charging? Like, does it feel like
it's a pandemic rent, but a pandemic rent in New York is still two times or three times.
Yeah, it still makes people in Iowa go, "What are you talking about?
It's like,
is it a mansion?"
We're not going to rip you off as much as we normally rip you off because we're sensitive to the pandemic is basically what it is. We have to furnish the apartment and, you know, we're a young couple with a baby, you know, and, you know, obviously we weren't going to go out for Black Friday because of, you know, the risk of disease. However, Cyber Monday, which is the internet version.
I thought you weren't going to participate in Black Friday because it's a celebration of American capitalism, which is destroying not only America, but the entire world.
Clearly, that wasn't the issue because I bought a bunch of shit on Cyber Monday, and now, I feel really bad about it.
The question is, it's also about where you bought it from. Did you pick any places that were like, support an independent business, support something that's locally grown?
From a used furniture store where every piece they plant a tree and the whole thing is recycling old furniture so we don't have to keep.
Is that really true? You did this?
Yeah.
So it's someplace in Brooklyn, clearly.
In New Jersey.
Okay, all right. Yeah. New Jersey.
I'm not going to say the name of the site because they're not paying us, unless we can get them, and then I would appreciate a discount. But yeah, it's great.
Wait,
it's,
you got a Cyber Monday discount and you want another discount on top of that?
I mean, I got a $200 Cyber Monday discount. I wanted a greater discount. It wasn't even that much of a discount, so I probably could have waited, but I did buy it on Cyber Monday for the savings, and I feel bad about it. In some ways, these are essential purchases. They save us money because we do have a baby child. But I knew what I was doing. We made our choices. You know, I also feel good. I didn't need to buy poke yesterday. We could have eaten in yesterday. That's a more frivolous purchase. Can you absolve me?
I mean, is the place you bought it from New Jersey? So you bought it online because it's Cyber Monday. Is it a part of it? Is it a chain store or is it a
I don't think so. It's a company, but it's a growing young company.
Yeah, you're supporting, and the people who work there, you're supporting. I mean, I think I think that only counts as Cyber Monday because you bought it online. I think of Cyber Monday, and I think of like exclusively like Amazon. But say their name. They did it. They gave you $200 off. They're nice people. They're not a major place. They'll appreciate it. I believe
it's called Kayo, K-A-I-Y-O. I will say their name also because we're not sure if the dining table we bought actually fits through the door of our apartment. We probably should have measured it before we made that decision. So I will say the name in case perhaps we need to exchange something.
You're supporting local business. That's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I absolve you of that. The poke thing, I have feelings about only because I think I don't like poke.
I mean, a part of me kind of knows, like, shit, I don't think I'm going to get invited to the socialism conference again this year.
I mean,
probably not going to happen, to be fair.
I think they always knew inviting you was a risk. I think you get to do things like that because they know you're on the edge of socialism.
But still far enough off the ledge where I can justify buying stuff on Cyber Monday.
American socialists have to buy things, too. Which is a book I'm writing. This podcast is called Politically Reactive, and there was some pretty interesting news in politics this past weekend. President-elect Joe Biden, Trump has decided that he's going to allow to
to
be the next president. He's been very gracious. Our dictator is gracious. Appointed, and for the first time ever, an all-female communications team. So that means press secretary, like all the positions about talking to the media is all women, many women of color. It's the first time that it's ever happened, which is only interesting because it's just one of those things like it's one of those first where it's like, that's amazing. It's weird that that had never happened. I feel like with black people, that happens all the time, too. It's the first black doctor who ever was a doctor in this office on Wednesdays. Wow. Also, what was going on Wednesdays? Racist Wednesdays? But which is great. And one of the people specifically I'm excited about is Simone Sanders, who I've met through CNN. I hung out with her at South by Southwest a couple years ago. And in 2016, worked with Bernie Sanders. And with this election, she went to Joe Biden. I just was like, wow, you go from Bernie Sanders to Joe Biden. Like, what are you doing? She would say winning is what she was doing. So like, she made the right choice. But it's also I'm happy for her because she's a real one, as they say. I know that if she goes in there, that she's taking her whole self with her. She's not going to kowtow to some sort of neoliberalism thing. That she's going to take all that energy she took to Bernie into this. But I'm just happy that she is in the halls of power because she's a really good person. So shout out to Simone Sanders.
So far, like, that end of the deal has been good. It feels like, all right, you got the right people in your ear. That's good.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think it's a little bit like, you know, it's a little of both. I think it's good for, you know, you get Simone Sanders. You also get John Kerry in charge of climate change. I don't know.
Didn't see that coming. I'll be honest with you. Didn't see John Kerry coming back.
No.
What was he under Obama?
He was Secretary of State. He was after Hillary.
Because I feel like it always makes more sense for him to be in a position where he could talk to the Iranians again to try to redo what he helped make the first time around. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
he was a big part of that deal, and then everything got fucked up because of Trump. It feels like it makes sense for him to go back, like, all right, where were we?
Where were we? Picking up where we left off.
Is he a big environmentalist guy? Like, I don't think I've ever...
I mean, I think apparently he's got some of that, but it's also like, you know, it's supposed to be some activist that the mainstream people haven't heard of. Who's angry and probably under 30. That's who it's supposed to It's supposed to be whoever Greta Thunberg goes, that's the person in America you want. That's who you want in America. It's supposed to be that person. Yeah. And then somebody else was appointed is being nominated for a position. In Joe Biden's cabinet, Neera Tanden, yes. Biden has nominated her to run the budget office, which is like, you know, the money. It's an important position. Are you familiar with Neera Tanden's work?
Yeah, I'm also South Asian and in political circles, so I'm trying to be, like, I can't plead the fifth, right? Yeah. But at the same time, I need to be tactful in my attack, because there will be somewhat of an attack, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, you know... Our moms know we... Oh, and you know my... Okay. Yeah. I'm also kind of like... Yeah.
The GOP is not happy about her. Some of them called out and said that they don't like the way she tweets, which obviously Chuck Schumer was already like, Oh, you don't like the way a political person tweets? Is that what you just said? But then also the left has called her out because GOP thinks of her as progressive. Progressives don't think of her as progressive because she's, you know, not a progressive. And so she has already come under fire, which she's used to. If you go to her Twitter feed, she's not there for fun. So she doesn't mind calling in the heat. But the funny thing for me is that we haven't said anything on this edition of the podcast, but we had a catchphrase on the old podcast. Do you remember what it was, Hurry?
Fuck Bill Maher.
Yeah, fuck Bill Maher. So and that was all because for many things, but also for me, it stemmed personally from when I was booked to do his show real time. Right after Totally Biased was canceled, I was in a real damaged place. And I went on that show and I wrote about it. He just wasn't, there was nothing fun or nice about that show. Surprise. And it's also a little bit like tricky, trying to catch you so he can look good, which I've talked about before. Well, who was sitting next to me as Bill Maher tried to make me look bad? Neera Tanden.
I forgot about that.
Every time I see her, I sort of remember, like, you were right there.
I have that with Preet Bharara.
Oh.
Yeah. I did a show for some organization, like a young Indian professionals organization, and it was in this huge ballroom, and I was sitting next to him and former Miss America Nina Davaluri. Because when you're, a South Asian notable person, then, you know, everybody, regardless of your political power or place, you all kind of sit together. And so I had to perform, and instead of performing on the stage, they made me perform on the dance floor in the middle of the room where I bombed terribly and then had to return to the stage to sit next to Preet Bharara, who wouldn't make eye contact with me again. So Neera Tanden brings you back to that terrible moment. Yes. In your life with Bill Maher. I mean, there's a lot of criticism of her, especially, I mean, she was definitely a Hillary hawk and did not do Bernie any favors and certainly is blamed for some of the stuff that happened in 2016, which, by the way, when people were upset that Bernie Sanders didn't concede soon enough in 2016, mm-hmm. I want you to think about right now. And I want you to look at whoever else is there and how many of them are from the progressive left. Mm-hmm. So when you say, how come Bernie doesn't get on the team and endorse Hillary faster or Biden faster? Why didn't Liz Warren endorse Biden? Let's see what they're going to do after the fact, because it seems like that endorsement happens and they immediately forget. You did what we told you to do, and now we're going to ignore everything that you had to say. So, okay, look, Neera Tanden, not my favorite decision there. South Asian woman, that's great. We're still in that era where that's great. I get it. It's first. But at the same time, is Bernie going to get the, you know, Secretary of Labor? No. Are we going to get Liz Warren in a position of power? Because at a certain point, it's like, why do you keep asking the progressive left to endorse your moderate, middle of the road, doesn't support $15 an hour minimum wage candidates, and then you backstab us. You're alienating your future base, and you actively do it. And in the next election, what do you think is going to happen? When people say there's all these divisions in the Democratic Party and the Republicans stick together, yeah, it's easy when you're the status quo. When you're the status quo, you don't need to worry about the little differences because you're in power. You want things to be the way they are. When you're trying to create progressive change, you have to find ways to build those connections. And that's always put on the progressive left to build those connections. It's always on us to suppress our identity politics, to suppress this movement, to not push for that. Why are we talking about Black Lives Matter? Let's be moderate when we talk about police death. We need to be more moderate when we talk about the police killing people. When police murder people, it's a time for moderation? Fuck you. It's frustrating, Kamau. Like, are you fucking kidding me? It's the same shit every time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And that's why I think it's important that we hold the receipts that we have from the election. I think it's important that, like, you know, Black folks, Indigenous folks, Latinx folks who know that they did the work to flip those red states, hold those receipts and show those receipts. That's why I'm glad Simone Sanders is in there. And as we will talk about with today on the show, we have your good friend, the sister of your writing partner, which every time I hear that, I'm like, I don't have a sister. Oh, that's right. He's talking about Aham. But Ijoma Oluwo is on the show today. And she has a take on this, too, that we will hear about.
And she also has, like, just a really interesting life and a life trajectory, which we'll talk about. Like, you know, when I met her, I didn't think a huge writing career was in her way. Not because she's not capable, because that was not the direction she was going
in.
She
didn't know she was in that direction yet.
No. So it just sounds like I'm happy that someone who is that genuine and such a powerful writer is actually being read. It's great.
Yeah. And she's here to talk about her new book, Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. And she will also talk about what it was like to have her first book, So You Want to Talk About Race, skyrocket to the top of the New York Times bestseller list in the wake of George Floyd's murder by the Minneapolis police. And then after we talk to Ijoma, we're going to talk to comedian Sarah Silverman, a comedian who courts controversy at many different angles, but also has done a lot of good political work. And as we talk about in the interview, we've seen evolve in real time if you've followed her career. And she talks about that. And also we talk a little bit about how my first sort of like bite at the apple of fame and people knowing who I am was criticizing her in her film Jesus is Magic. And we've talked about it in the past, but it comes up again.
And it was on a social media site that some of you might be familiar with. And no, it's not Friendster.
Let's just be clear. When MySpace said, we're deleting all your pages, I was like, that was like getting your FBI file burned, as far as I was concerned. I was like, oh, thank you. so we'll talk to Sarah later. But before that, we'll talk to Ijoma. Ijoma Oluwo is the author of the 2018 New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race.
And this week, she's out with her latest book, Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. Ijoma, it is so good to have you on Politically Reactive. You and I have known each other for 15 years.
Yes.
We met in Seattle because your brother, Ahmed Fleh, and I are great friends. We're writing partners. We're incredibly close. And I knew you as Aham's sister, who is incredibly politically minded, who worked at the time, I believe, at a cell phone company, and who would show up at different events that I would do that were political, and you would be so brilliant, and I would think, why is she working at a cell phone company? and I think it was stunning to see your climb, and not because you're not capable, obviously, but because you didn't have a path, I think, like a lot of authors tend to have, which is, you know, I have a dream of being an author, and I went to school to write, and then I'm going to take a couple of years off to intern at publishing houses and make connections and use my privilege and get whatever I want to get. And yours is not that story. And I thought, like, a good way to start was for you to tell us kind of your story into writing, because to me, it's incredibly impressive, and it also kind of proves that when you are doing the work and you write and you put the effort in and you're just brilliant, it somehow it's going to happen.
You know, as a kid, I absolutely loved writing. Like, I wrote nonstop as a kid, and I was that kid where teachers would be like, let's come up with more writing projects for Ijoma to do. So she leaves us alone because she's just always trying to do more writing. But by the time I hit like middle school, it was pretty obvious that, you know, if you're a poor Black kid, saying I'm going to be a writer one day was not what was going to get you off welfare. Like, it wasn't going to keep your electricity on. And you know, we grew up in that kind of level of poverty. And I was the oldest daughter. And I think often, you know, for Black women especially, like, you're turned into an adult very young, where the idea of responsibility, like, there's no time to be frivolous. There's no time to have dreams of anything, you know. So what I did was, you know, decided I was going to go into tech. But I also had young children, and children young. My son when I was 20, and my second at 27. And, you know, took them up with me to college, took my oldest with me to college, and got a degree in political science because I needed a degree. And then went back into tech and worked at, yeah, I worked for cell phone companies. And then I worked in automotive digital marketing and was marketing Chevrolets and Buicks and things like that throughout the West. But, you know, for me, I started writing because of necessity. Writing was still something that was there for me on a personal level when I needed to kind of be able to explain how the world was working. And I think also because I had kind of been raised to think things were not about me. And I think for a lot of Black women especially, and for a lot of women, the idea is that you take care of everyone, take care, you know, of what needs to be taken care of, and you don't have time for, you know, worrying about and processing things. And so I would write to kind of process. And when Trayvon Martin was murdered, that's when I started really writing again. I started writing because, you know, I was working in this really hostile environment. You know, I don't know if this is a shock to anyone. Chevrolet is a predominantly white male company. You know, the auto industry is predominantly white and male. And I was traveling, you know, to all these dealerships and hearing sexist comments, hearing racist comments. And I was scared and I was grieving and I needed someone to say something. And so at first I was really writing like, if I can just explain it maybe in some sort of way to my coworkers, to my peers, to my friends, the people I grew up with, then they will get it. And they didn't, shocker. They did not get it. Yeah. You know, I lost most of my friends, strained a lot of relationships. But I think because I was writing to just try to connect and to share, not because I wanted to build this big grand career, it connected with people in a way that I hadn't expected. And so other people who were trying to find a way to explain how they felt, especially first other Black people and then other people of color, started reaching out. And then I started getting requests, you know, from magazines and newspapers saying, can we republish your Facebook post from the other day? And I was like, what? And I remember like the height of absurdity was, you know, because I was still like literally working in a car dealership. I was the only woman in my building and I was the only Black person. And I remember going and sitting in my car and hiding and doing an interview with New York Magazine about the murder of Michael Brown and knowing I could not take that call at work. And I realized I just had to quit. And so I quit. And it was so, I think everyone was shocked because I had always been the responsible one, you know, and I had a mortgage and I had no savings and I just quit and had to hustle. And I think this is where growing up poor served me well because my hustle game was strong. I was doing every side gig, every talent I had while writing. It just started picking up. I just kept fighting and fighting and fighting and saying, you know what, Ijoma, you've been too honest too long. You really can't go back and sit in the cubicle now. Like, you have to find a way to make this work. I had to build everything kind of from the ground up. I didn't know how to pitch. I didn't know what it was. I had, you know, you have a visual idea of a pitch and you're like, okay, I'm tossing something at someone, but that's all I knew.
Pitching an article or pitching a book.
Exactly. And I had no idea what it meant to pitch an article. And I remember, you know, having to swallow my pride and be like, well, I guess you're going to have to ask, you know, and everyone was like, what? You don't know what a pitch is? I'm like, no. And then it turned out no one knows what a pitch is, by the way. It's a class I teach all the time.
So I guess and I was also raised by a single Black mom. So I've been on the inside of that, too. What are the things that are good about that, that you feel like society sort of like is always like saying that's the worst thing to be? Me and my mom used to joke about it, like that I came from a broken home because we were having a good time on the inside. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, man. You know what? Like, I wouldn't have been able to do anything I did without my kids. Honestly, I can say that 100%, especially because there's a couple things. One, you really can't fuck things up when you have kids. Like, you can't be like, oh, well, you know, if this doesn't work, I'll just try something else. No, you can't. Like, you have to feed your kids. You have limited time. Like, you dedicate your time to it. But also, they keep me grounded. The work I do can be really, really depressing. It can be really, really tough. And there's something to be said for, you know, spending a day looking up, like, stories of genocide and then having a kid be like, Mom, we're out of snacks. You know, and you're like, like, okay, all right, the world still goes on. But, you know, it's, I also think, you know, I have two boys. Them watching a woman, watching a Black woman build her life from the ground up and seeing what goes into it and the dedication and then seeing the reward that comes with it, I think is so important. Like, they've seen what it looks like. Their primary role model has been a Black woman who built her life and who didn't let anyone in her home who was disrespectful and pushed for goals and was defined herself by what she was putting out into the world. And there's just an endless motivation for me. You know, not to say that it's always easy, but I don't think I would have been inspired to push through if I didn't know, you know, that they benefit from this work. I can say this too, honestly. It is way easier to do this with lovely kids than it is with like a shitty partner, you know? Mm-hmm. And there are so many times where I knew when I was partnered, when I was married, that I couldn't build my career with them. But with the kids, I'd never thought that.
You've had a really complicated, fascinating, interesting year, both personally and in terms of work. Your house burned down, which we can talk about more in a little bit, but that obviously is incredibly traumatic, and I'm so glad that you and your family are safe. You released your next book is coming out, Mediocre, which I'm very excited.
Hurry, that sounded like a judgment. That didn't sound like you were saying the title. Try that again.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. Your next book came out. It is called Mediocre. It is not mediocre. It is called Mediocre. And also, your first book, So You Want to Talk About Race, shot to the bestseller list again after the death of the murder of George Floyd. I mean, it's obviously been a bittersweet year in a lot of ways. Is that also part of that bittersweet year? And in one way, your book is being read even more broadly and widely. People are appreciating work that should be read. And at the same time, what triggered so much of it was the death of another black man at the hands of the police. Like, you know, how do you take that all in? Because on one hand, I'm sure it felt good to be like, people are reading this book, it's good. But mm-hmm. it also, this happened at the same time.
Yeah, it was really traumatic, honestly. I didn't know how to, you know, because first and foremost, I'm a black woman, right? And I was just grieving. You know, I remember sitting with my partner and we were both just kind of sitting in the living room crying, you know, looking at the news and just feeling heartbroken and gutted again, you know, in the midst of this pandemic. And we were already so stretched so thin, you know, seeing peers and friends and community members die from the pandemic. And then to get a call saying, you're number one in the New York Times bestseller list, and knowing, oh, it's because of this. Mm. Like, this is what, you know, people could be reading about this all along, but they're going to wait. It was awful. Like, at first, it was really, I didn't want to engage with it. Like, you know, my agent was being so sweet. Like, she immediately called, because she knows me so well, she called the publisher and was like, please do not send flowers. Do not call. We don't need any congratulations right now. Like, this is a lot to process. You know? Wow. I was really upset at first, really bitter. You know, I'm so proud of the book. I think it's a very, very good book. But it's not what I imagined people would be turning to in the wake of a brutal murder. I was hoping people would be turned, you know, talking about how can we burn down this system, not how can we talk about race. And, you know, I had to come to terms with, of course, this is where people are, right? Because that's why I ended up having to write the book. But it made me mad because my book is one of many, many tools that have been there, you know, and that people hadn't been engaging with. And it was really, really frustrating. A couple of things kind of pulled me out of that space a little bit. I'm still kind of in it. I think I'll be in it. I think I live in that space always. But part of what pulled me out from like the deepest parts of it was one, Angela Davis. When the protests started, these, you know, beautiful, huge, heartbreaking, intersectional protests started, hearing Angela Davis say that she was glad she lived long enough to see it, like, maybe be like, who are you, Ijoma, to be bitter in this moment right now? Like, you've got Angela Davis here, grateful for this moment. And then hearing from, you know, every corporation wanted to read my book and wanted to talk about it. And it was really frustrating to see these, you know, hyper-capitalist companies that hadn't given a shit, you know, suddenly having these reading groups. But then to hear from people who work in those spaces and saying, hey, this is making it better for me. Like, this is helping me. I feel safer than I felt. You know, I can't discount that. I try to remember that, you know, what that feels like, you know, that to walk into a space where 10, 12 hours a day, you can't be your whole self, where you have to calculate everything that comes out of your mouth. You know, every response you have, you have to be constantly aware and what that takes from you. And anything that, you know, I can do to help with that, you know, and knowing what that would have meant for me to have someone come in and just call shit out and know that they weren't going to get fired because they don't work there. And having it give me a little breathing room would have meant a ton to me, you know? And so I tried not, you know, I have to remember, I can't discount that matters. I still want it all to burn down. I do. I absolutely do. But I also know that there are, you know, there's people, you know, I always remember there are people of color in these systems day in and day out who have to be and deserve, while we are trying to find a way to actually change these systems, to revolutionize these systems, they still have to get by.
You know what you say, I think about a lot when I get asked to do those corporate things, like doing it in such a way that the black people who work at the company feel like a little bit more space and not like you came in and said, made it harder on them.
Exactly.
Trying to realize in those spaces, I think I try to even be more hardcore than I normally am just so mm-hmm. that it can create some space for them. Because the last thing I want for them is to go like, he got it all wrong, and now my life is worse.
He said we should
all just hug each other.
Right? No, and you know what, though? That's hella real, though. That's why, I mean, part of the reason why there's this backlash against DEI work in corporations, one is, you know, it's by Republican right-wing design, right? Like, you know, but also the truth is that a lot of times HR uses DEI and these equity talks as a way to avoid lawsuits. Like, they have someone who comes in and says, here's how to make the racism quieter. And then you can say, well, we have this so-and-so in. We're obviously not racist.
She wrote a hit book.
Exactly.
So opposite, yeah.
And so I come in like, look, I have my check already, you know? So
I've done that before. It's such a good feeling to let everybody know. It's like, I've already taken their money and they can't get it back. So I will tell you the truth.
Exactly. They're not inviting me back anyways, right? You know, this is a one-time thing. I'm absolutely going to say everything I can.
When you told me that you were going to write a book about white mediocrity, I was just stunned. Like, that is so brilliant. And I can't believe that no one else has ever written a book about something that every person of color thinks about. Like, I feel like every person of color can write several hundred pages of their own personal experiences. You know, not, of course, with your lens, but, like, just, like, you know, because ultimately the dream is not about the cream rising to the top. It's about the ability to be mediocre and still succeed, mm-hmm. right? Because that's what white people have had forever, especially white men. You don't need to be a star in order to get yours, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea of the book is incredible. What did looking at it with, you know, looking at race and history with the lens of white male mediocrity add to your analysis? Like, what did you get from that?
Oh, man. Well, you know, a couple of things. One is it underscored for me the fact that we absolutely can never separate patriarchy and white supremacy in America. They exist together, even when we're talking about white women and the role that they play. Also, just the absurd lengths to which this country goes to protect white male mediocrity. If you ever had an idea that there was some sort of logical argument you could make that appealed more than the basic identity of feeling like as a white man you are better than women and people of color, you're wrong. There isn't anything right now. It just won't exist. You could say, hey, you'll die if you don't, you know, help raise the status of the people of color. And you'd be like, cool, let me die. It's fine, whatever. Like, it's so wild. And that was something that when people say in this election and the last election and the last election, why are white people voting against their best interests? Like, you know what? I think you need to reevaluate what their interests are, because the interests are not actually tied to how well they're doing, how well their family's doing. It's tied to, when you look in the mirror, do you still feel better than? Do you feel better than women, better than people of color? And that is the interest that rises above all else, because that's all in a hyper-capitalism you can guarantee white men, is that at the end of the day, there's still going to be a person of color who's below you.
Can you lay out an example of how America has tried to keep white mediocrity present at all costs, or protect white mediocrity at all costs?
Can I go? Yeah. Can I go?
Yeah, I know, right?
I like this game. We should play this more often. No, you go, Joe. I'm just kidding.
Christian Laettner is assuming.
There's so many.
I mean, there's so many. Like, there's the whole book. There's so many things in there that are absurd. And like, even, you know, when we're talking about something everyone kind of knows about, which is the Great Migration.
Hold up! Wait a minute.
The Great Migration was the relocation of more than 6 million black folks from the rural South to the cities of the North, Midwest, and West from about 1915 to 1970.
Driven from their homes by lynchings and segregationist laws, many African Americans headed north, where they took advantage of the need for industrial workers that arose during the First World War, where a factory wage was typically three times more than what black people could expect in the South.
In the decade between 1910 and 1920, the black population of major northern cities exploded, increasing by over 500% in cities like Philadelphia and Detroit.
As a result of redlining and racist violence, black people ended up creating their own cities within bigger cities, the most prominent example being Harlem in New York. Harlem was previously an all-white neighborhood, but by the 1920s, it became home for 200,000 black Americans, end of the Harlem Renaissance.
So wait, are you saying black folks gentrified Harlem?
Is that what you want me to say?
But what was interesting to me was in looking at the response. So the moment the biggest, the largest, and most important labor force in the South started leaving, the South started panicking. Now, there are a lot of things. If you had a labor force that was unhappy and leaving, and they were unhappy because of the terror and violence you were visiting upon them, and you wanted them to stay, logic would say, let up on the terror and violence. But when you are so committed to the idea that you have physical power over a people, instead the response was people caught trying to leave were beaten and jailed and had their money taken away. And that, and then they were like, what, why don't they want to stay? Why isn't this working? Why aren't we getting, like, that was literally, like, the response was, well, if, what if we beat them more? When I was researching that, the flashback I had was when Seattle PD invited me and a lot of other activists and commentators on race relations to a tour of their northern precinct because they were trying to get approval for funding for a new precinct, one of the largest in the country. And we were saying, no, you're still under consent decree. You're assholes. You abuse people. We don't have sidewalks in that particular part of town. We would rather have sidewalks. And so they brought us on this tour. And the first thing they did was they pulled out their SWAT gear. They pulled out their SWAT gear, and I'll always remember Kashama Swant picking up a piece of body armor and just holding it, like, what? And they were like, look at this, it's everywhere. We don't have a place to store our SWAT gear. It's so awful, we're running out of room. And we're like, okay. And then they brought us to, and they said they didn't have enough room to hold the kids that they arrest. And they were like, we don't have enough room to hold these children we're arresting. Then they were like, sometimes we have to share cubicles. It's horrible. We've run out of cubicle space. And then they brought us to the gun range. This gun range is only 100 feet. And sometimes you have to shoot people from more than 100 feet. We need a bigger gun range. This is like, they brought a room full of black activists in, and this was, they couldn't imagine a relationship with us different. They couldn't imagine seeing us as human beings who are actually afraid for our lives and fighting for our lives. They couldn't step out of that power dynamic for one second, where even when it was absolutely in our best interest, when they were literally trying to convince us of something, all they could think was, let's show them where we practice shooting them. When I was researching this part and writing down all the different things that, you know, white Southerners were doing to try to get black people to stay, let's just keep trying the same, let's push the same thing, let's push the thought, even if it would benefit them, and it would have benefited them in both times to break from this power dynamic, to look at us differently as human beings and not just as subjects, they couldn't. And you know, they didn't get their precinct either, you know? And when you look through history, there's so many times where you're like, if you just even shifted a little bit, you could get this thing you desperately want. Nope, not gonna happen. It's just, it's shocking. And yet not, because it's the tale of our country.
What other costs are there to white mediocrity that you thought about?
There's so many. And you know, especially if we're looking at like white male mediocrity, right? Because it's this idea of power and aggression and oppression and relative power, right? All power is relative. It has nothing to do with your individual strengths, your talents. It has to do with how much more you have or how much better you're doing than others. It costs us so many. I mean, looking at our political system, you know, I have a whole chapter talking about the ways in which, you know, we all know the politics in America don't work. Like, everyone, no one is like, woohoo, this system's the best, it's so great. No one is saying that, right? But the truth is that the people who have the best ideas as to how to change it are women of color in our government right now, or who are advising or protesting. And the thought of listening to them, you know, or even acknowledging the ways in which communities of color have bypassed these ineffective and harmful systems to survive, and thinking, what would it look like to learn from these things and, you know, make it easier for us to actually use these systems? Nope. We're not going to do that, right? And that's a huge cost. The idea that any political change we make has to be non-threatening to the identity of white men as the center of our political system means that we stagnate our political system. Looking at what it means for our businesses and the traits that we prioritize and say are great, you know, for every like weirdo asshole like Elon Musk who are like, look, see, be like Elon Musk, we see white dudes try that shit and tank business after business after business and end up massive layoffs of employees, you know, loss of investor funds, right? When we, time and time again, we look at what this costs. But also what it means is that if you are trying to just get by as a person of color and figure out where your talents lie, you have to find it within this narrow avenue of what's available to you, what resources you have, what bandwidth you have, how you can seek it in a way that won't seem threatening, how you can voice your new ideas and opinions in a way that won't get you fired. And we miss out on the talents of anyone who isn't this particular narrow idea of a white man, or people who aren't willing to emulate that. It should be enough that it costs us. It should be enough that we are losing our lives and our potential, our ability to thrive in this society. It should absolutely be enough. But if you think, like, if you're a white person and you think there's a way you can have a thriving economy and a safe and productive society when you have large minorities of people who are suffering and unable to accumulate any wealth or any sense of safety, you are wrong. You will not be able to get that for your neighborhood. Your, you know, gated neighborhoods will not hold. And I think that it's vital that people understand that.
So when you put yourself in these positions of calling out the police, and earlier you're talking about you want the system to be burned down, you get pushback, to put it lightly, harassment and worse, and threats. I know me and Hurry both call out systems and have said similar types of things, not as eloquently. But I always notice that I don't get the same level of attacks that I see women who are in those same spaces, specifically black women and women of color getting it. What is it to live in that space?
I had like a little meltdown about it the other day because we were trying to look at like what are our safety protocols like as a family. And having those, as someone who's always been really stubbornly determined to not change a lot of parts of my life, was frustrating. And it can be really tough. You know, we've had times where we had to move. We had to move last year because our home was swatted.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
So swatting is awful. It's a really shitty thing to do. It's a way to harass someone by sending an unneeded emergency service to their home. Like you call in a bomb threat or say someone has a gun or make up some other out of control criminal situation that requires the police or other emergency services to show up. It first received national attention on December 28, 2017, when a Wichita police officer shot and killed Andrew Finch in his Kansas home. It turned out Finch was the unintended victim of the swatting after two Call of Duty players on the same team got into a heated argument about $1.50. A California man was sentenced to 20 years in prison for carrying out the swatting.
Laws against swatting vary, but in California, swatters bear the full cost of the response, which can lead to fines up to $10,000. In 2018, the Seattle Police Department focused more resources on combating swatting by educating 911 dispatchers to identify potential swatting calls, ensuring responding officers are aware of the potential for a hoax situation, and creating an opt-in registry for people who fear that they may become victims of swatting, such as journalists, celebrities, live streamers, and women in general.
It is really difficult to have that sort of fear in you. And it's also difficult too because people don't ride for black women. You know, like to know that you're not gonna have quite the support and the care that anyone else would. were they facing those regular threats, and that people will assume that it's just a part of the job that you should get used to. You know, well, oh, you're saying things. You should expect threats and, you know, intimidation, and, you know, you should expect to get a bomb threat every time you do a public event. You should expect all these. No, we shouldn't. But what I try to remember is what is coming for Black people, what comes for Black women in this country is not the, you know, the response to the work I do. It's, you know, you said something to a dude at work and you lost your job and you can't keep a roof over your head, right? It's, you know, those basic things, like you needed legal representation and you couldn't get it, or you had a judge that was going to see you not as someone, you know, worthy of care and rehabilitation, but as an unrepentant criminal. You know, your kids aren't seen as students worth teaching in a school. Those are the things that come for you. You know, those are still the things that come for you. And I have to remember that if I wasn't doing this work, the terror I face is just looks different. But that being said, you know, I'm a human being, and of course I get scared and I get sad, and I do worry. You know, I also have learned it's never tied to any particular thing I'm doing. These dudes are not reading my books. Like, they're not reading my books and going, oh, you know, this point makes me mad, you know.
On page 38, I really don't like the point you made.
Exactly. They're just mad that I'm a Black woman taking up space, and that they know that people are listening to me, whatever it is I'm saying, because they don't actually know. And recognizing that, like, the backlash I faced, not even backlash, the terrorism that my family and I have faced over the years has never actually been tied directly to my work. Like, the first time I really experienced it was when I tweeted about Cracker Barrel. Made no fucking sense. Mm. None at all. You know, I had an article titled "White People Will Always Let You Down." Crickets. Nothing. Because they're not reading that. But then I say, I'm uncomfortable in this Cracker Barrel, and it's months of harassment and threats. Ridiculous. You know, when we got swatted, my book had already been out for, you know, a year and a half. And they had to put quotes in this website, in the dark web, talking about, to try to get people to swap me. They were like, she hates white people. Here's a quote, you know, because they knew no one was ever going to read my work. Mm. So it's not tied to that. It's the fact that I exist. It's the fact that I am a Black woman in this space, that I live as, you know, more free than they think I should, that I am honest, you know, and that people listen to me.
I remember, you know, when I found out that your home had burnt down earlier in the year, and I think a lot of people had the same reaction. It was, oh my God, they burnt Ijoma's home down. Like, that was my first, and I remember the absurdity of thinking, oh, thank God it was an electrical fire. Like, the idea, I would even think, thank God it was an electrical fire. You still lost everything. It was still this incredibly traumatic thing, but that somehow ended up in my head because of all of the pressure and all the threats that have been made against you.
Oh yeah, no, that was real time what we were thinking. Like, we were like, thank goodness, because we were like, why? What's happening? What's happening? What's happening? And then, you know, once we realized what we thought it probably was, and that it was, you know, just a freak fire, likely a battery explosion from our lawnmower, we were like, oh, phew. Huh, okay. You know, just some random thing can burn your house down. That's way better, you know.
So your book is about white mediocrity. It seems like we can't leave this conversation with you without talking about Joe Biden and where you feel like he falls into white mediocrity. Also, at the same time, they announced that his communication team is all women, many women of color, the first time in the history of this country. So is that a moment to be celebrated? Where does this all end?
All right. So one, I would say, Joe Biden is absolutely in this book. So if you, you know, he's in there. And I wrote this before the election, you know, but he's in there. And so I don't think you would read this book and then look at where we are right now and be like, shocking. No, you would look at it and be like, okay, yeah, all right. This figures, this tracks. I look forward to pushing and criticizing and protesting the next administration. And I think that we can absolutely celebrate the accomplishments of women, of Black women, of women of color, and then expect that we honor those positions, that the government, that Joe Biden honors those women of color with true empowerment. I am not naive enough to think that, it, you know, we would have a different system if you could just put a black woman in and suddenly things would change. We had a black president, and, you know, we saw the limitations of that. So what I am looking forward to is the ability to protest and push and know that perhaps the response we're met with is not as violent. I think right now it's really cool to toss out any accomplishments for anybody in this system. And I think it's no coincidence that because it's black women, you know, and even looking at Kamala Harris being the first black and woman vice president and Desi vice president, when it is black women, I think it's really easy for people to say it doesn't matter, it's not important, the system sucks, now they're a part of the system. And I think we should investigate why we so quickly do that instead of recognizing that, yes, it's part of the system, but this does make it perhaps easier for us when we are pushing and protesting and fighting the system. And, you know, if anything, you know what? If it's the same fucked up system, why not get some black women paid? You know, at the end of the day, like, why would I be mad about that? Like, you know, at least let black women profit off the mediocrity of the system for a change, you know?
Ijoma, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm so lucky to have you as a friend. And as a friend, I just want to say how proud I am of everything that you've done. And I can't wait for people to read Mediocre. I think it's not your mediocre book, but a book called Mediocre. It's fantastic, and I'm just so happy for you.
Thank you so much. It's so great to see you both. You know, I love everything y'all are doing, and it's great to see your faces.
Ijoma Oluwo's new book is Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America.
Because of the pandemic, Ijoma can't do the usual book tour.
So instead, she set up a series of conversations with thought leaders on topics related to white supremacy.
She'll be talking to soccer star Megan Rapinoe, fantasy writer Danielle Jose Older, filmmaker Dream Hampton, and SNL's Ego Nwodum.
And because it's virtual, you can participate wherever you are. Find out all about it at mediocrethebook.com.
Next up, we talk to comedian Sarah Silverman.
We want to hear your reactions to the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive. Leave us a message at 917-477-6525.
Again, that's 917-477-6525. Or use the hashtag PoliticallyReactive on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to tell us what you think and what you want.
And subscribe if you're not already subscribed. Share the episodes with the people you love. And give us a review on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. I guess also you could share the episodes with the people you hate.
Actually, it's more important if you share it with the people you hate.
That's true.
A click's a click.
Anyway, subscribe, share the episodes, give us reviews. It definitely makes a difference. Before we get into this interview with Sarah Silverman, just want to cover some things. Sometimes when we do interviews on this show, we know what we're going to talk to the person about. They're here to promote something or here to talk about a good cause or their work, and we're very clear on that. And sometimes with, like, comedians or people we know, the conversation is a lot more loose. So this conversation with Sarah was like that. And we got into some areas talking about, like, art versus the artist, and what do you do when you love the art but you don't like the artist, or you feel conflicted about the artist. And we weren't really expecting to get into that. We did. There's talk about Woody Allen. It's sort of a free-flowing conversation. But at some point, I realized that the elephant in the room was Louis C.K. and all of this, and we didn't bring it up, and Sarah didn't bring it up, but I just feel like me and her have talked about it. We just feel like we want to talk to you guys about it, that we are aware that he's a piece of that. So Sarah has talked about her feelings around Louis, who's a friend of hers, and where she stands in this. This is right after the allegations came out in the New York Times. She said, "I love Louis, but Louis did these things. Both of these statements are true. So I just keep asking myself, can you love someone who did bad things? Can you still love them? I can mull that over later, certainly because the only people that matter right now are the victims." So I feel like I just wanted to say that to you all. So that is her stance and her thoughts about her friend Louis C.K. But yeah.
For the record also, fuck Woody Allen. and I felt that way before the allegations. And now fuck Woody Allen and fuck Woody Allen.
Okay, also. And to be clear, on Politically Reactive, me and Hari and everyone working on the show stands with survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse. Yay, Sarah Silverman's here!
Woo!
How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm well. How are you guys?
You know, pandemicking, as we all are.
It's exciting to see others. Like, we get to see each other because it's on Zoom and it's, you know.
Yeah, are you finding that you're seeing people that you wouldn't have seen normally, but because it's people are now Zooming that you're, like, now maybe hanging out with people or talking to people that you wouldn't normally talk to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, yes. Us?
Sorry. You're just going to get yes or no question answers out of me. I'm such a good guest.
Well, yeah. So my first question I want a yes or no answer to is, do you realize how much I appreciated it when I first started to blow up, as they say, that in the early stages of my blowing up career, even though I was quite old, as you called me out for on TV, that people were fascinated with who my wife was. And for a long time, when they searched W. Kamau Bell wife, a picture of us hugging would come up.
Really?
Yes.
How did she feel about that?
She was fine with it because she didn't really need her face on the internet. But so she was like, I don't have a problem.
She's not damaged in the way that we are.
No. She was like, good. I hope that stays that way. Yeah.
I was hoping it'd be a picture of you and I hugging.
No. One of the things that I want to talk to you about is sort of the idea of comedians evolving in front of people. You know, you've had a career where you were on Saturday Night Live. You were a young comedian at that point. You were fairly young. And so I have seen you, and the people who are fans have seen you really evolve over time. I've seen people try to cancel you a couple times. I've seen you be the champion of the left a couple times. Like, what is that like on the inside?
You know, I've said for a long time, like, if you don't look at your old stuff and cringe, like, you're not growing, but, like, boy, I just cringe more than ever. It's just really, I don't like looking back at it. I take solace in just going like, you know, nothing matters. Really, you know, there's like an inspiring version of nothing matters. And then there's like a depressing version of nothing matters. And I like to think that mostly I think of the kind that inspires me, that just makes me go like, you know, we're on a planet in outer space. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you can't get like this wrapped up in Twitter and these things. But I do like to get my mind changed. Really looked for the t-shirt you gave me everywhere. I know I have it.
Oh.
Last night. And I was going to wear it today.
Oh, that would be like, so great.
Mostly not racist.
Mostly not racist, yes.
Did you have a line of those, or was that wasn't specifically for
me? No, because, I mean...
No, he made it for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, yes. At that point, I had a crew of people who I could go, make me a t-shirt that says mostly not racist. I mean, I wasn't... Hurry asked me if I was going to bring this up. I was like, it's such old news, but you brought up the mostly racist t-shirt. So for people listening, one of my first sort of like initial sort of like moments with like people, the internet sort of caring about who I am and sharing something I'd done... was an article I wrote on a website called MySpace. It wasn't an article. It was a post. An article. An op-ed I wrote on MySpace.
It wasn't like an essay.
It was an essay. Yes, yes. It was it's like a classic Vanity Fair, 5,000-word, well-researched, investigative journal.
It was a piece.
It was a piece, yes, that I wrote for MySpace that I was just, I had seen Jesus' magic. I had thoughts on it. I was in my feelings about my thoughts. I look back on it now and I realize it's not that I didn't have those thoughts, but I was very much like, you know, sort of like leaning into my power as somebody who was writing on MySpace. And it got taken by like a couple websites and sort of shared around. And then suddenly I was like, people were sort of like, I knew that I was known for that. And I was like, and at that point I was like, I didn't want people to see it other than my 300 MySpace friends. You know what I mean? So like it was, and we talked about it when you were on Totally Biased.
Yeah, but it's funny because I look back and I think it's right on the money, you know? I mean...
So the funny thing is, the thoughts I certainly understand and where I had them at, I just think that knowing how the internet worked, I would have approached it differently. And also, I think I've become a real sort of like, in my evolution of like, nobody likes the sheriff of comedy. it's sort of like, I think.
Right. Like, it, ultimately, it's comedy, but if the special wasn't popular, it wouldn't have probably rubbed you. Mm-hmm. But, like, the fact that it's like, oh, this is, people are raising this up, you know? Mm-hmm. Or I don't know.
What makes you go, that stuff's not good anymore? Is it just the fact that, like, I'm a better, I can write better race jokes now? Like, or what is it?
I think it's that I know more and I can't unring that bell, nor would I want to. I mean, watching Philando Castile in 2016 on my phone and going, oh my God, there's like an epidemic of cops killing black people. And then just a couple beats later going, oh, this isn't an epidemic. This is how it is. I just see it on social media now.
Yeah.
And that was massive. I knew there was racism, but I had no idea the scope of it and the depth of it and the roots of it. It changed everything I said.
I am a huge fan, but I was also a huge fan in your earlier incarnation. Because me and my best friend saw Jesus is Magic live, I think in 2004. And it was something like we were excited and it was an incredible special. And I remember earlier this year, you know, we were exchanging emails and I said, are you going to do something to mark the 15-year anniversary of Jesus is Magic? And you pretty firmly shot back, no. No, I will not. And then it hit me like, oh, right. I mean, it was because it's a, like, to me, I was thinking about it as a fan of you of that era when I was, you know, in my early 20s and thinking, like, this is incredible because you were, you know, you are such an incredible comic. And now when I hear your stuff, it's like, oh, she's used her superpowers in a very different way than she used them back then. What was the shift? Because clearly, like, I hear your voice now and it's like, you're just as incredible, if not even an even better joke writer. Like, the stuff is so, like, pointed and thoughtful. And the stuff before was still personal and brilliant, but certainly, like, you know, resonated very differently. So what started that evolution for you?
I will say, like, just the last thing about Jesus is Magic, there's a lot about it I'm proud of. It's just, it's not all one thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's just brought in pieces of it that make me... that, you know, are a bummer. But I mean, I thought it was like super far. You know, there's a moment where I wipe a tear and flick it and the tear goes all the way into the wings and Steve Agee catches it and jerks off with it. And it's just a tiny moment in between jokes. Like, it had so many cool things about it.
Would you recommend somebody who's listening to this go watch it, or would you just...
No. I mean, yeah, sure. You know, dare I call it art, you'll see something different than if you saw it then, you know, and you'll see something different in 10 years than if you saw it today, you know, so mindfully, yes, sure. It's complicated art, isn't it? You know, it's like Woody Allen. I don't know what the truth is there. I feel like we'll never know because every time a new child or sibling writes a new piece, I'm like, that's right. You know, oh, that's right. You know, I'm like... But I just don't want anyone to take Crimes and Misdemeanors away from me. Like, that movie just was huge for, like, not comedically even, it's a drama, but it's just like, it opened my mind up in certain ways that I don't want to negate. Artists are scumbags. Mm-hmm. A lot of artists are fucking scumbags. I don't know. What's the answer? What do you guys think?
Well, I think with stand-up, what's interesting is, you know, we make ourselves vulnerable, more vulnerable, I think, than any other kind of artist, because even a singer or a musician, they can hide behind the music and you don't actually know what they think or feel. And often people don't want to know what they think or feel. They just want to hear the music. But our whole job is to put ourselves out there, which is our strength. That's why people love us. But it also means that when somebody doesn't like something we do, there is a direct line to us. If you don't like a movie, right, who are you going to protest? The studio, the actors, the producers, the casting? It's like there is no single target. You can always deflect to somewhere else. There is no single place you can focus your wrath. But when you say something on a stage, it's you. You wrote it. You said it. It's public. And so because we make ourselves so vulnerable and because we're so honest, there's something dishonest, I think, about art that requires more production values. we are like the purest thing. So as a result, like we take the bigger hit. So, you know, as much as I think that as performers, we should be held accountable. And at the same time, like I see the fact that we're being held accountable means people are listening to us and they value what we have to say, which is what we, I think, as comedians in particular want. Like, you actually are listening to what we're saying and you remember it, even though you're criticizing it, you remember it. It made some impact. I always think it's like it doesn't, the wrath doesn't match the offense when it comes to jokes, I think.
Right.
Just because.
And then on the other side of that, I mean, I agree with you completely. But then on the other side of that, it's like if you consider yourself, you know, risky, then the risk is consequences.
Right. There is such a long line of incredibly talented writers, performers, and a lot of them are marginalized people, you know, whether they're women or members of the LGBT community, people of color, who never get their shot and are finally starting to get their shot. So to me, if you're like someone who's incredibly privileged and you've been able to make these incredible pieces of art and now all of a sudden, like, we realize all the fucked up stuff you do and you still exist, time's up. It's done now. And now let another person of color get that money that you are being given by studios and that and the claim and the space you get when people review your work, give that to somebody else now. And that, to me, is part of the penance. That's part of the karma of it.
Well, let's talk about your podcast. What's the impetus behind that?
Well, to be honest, not being able to do stand-up. I mean, I've never gone this long since I was a teenager, you know, of not doing stand-up. And I just felt like I got to do something. I go, yeah, I want to do a podcast. And I really love it. But it's funny because I've done 10 episodes, you know, it's so early and it's 10 hours of content, but yes. You know, and I really love it. And I don't have guests. I just go, you know, just talk, but I have people call in and leave voicemails and that kind of establishes like the trajectory of the episode. I had to learn all the lessons that like I had to learn in stand-up so many years ago, all over again. Like, I can't believe I didn't know better. Like, the first couple episodes, I'm just fucking this, fucking that, you know, like my armor was up, you know, like fucking. And I listen back, I go, what am I, 19? Like, I can't believe, I don't, you know, I mean, I love swearing and I like using language, but like it had no impact. It was just like this embarrassing crutch. Like, I was just started stand up. It's so interesting to have to learn that again. And then like, just being like, well, why aren't people, there should be reviews of it. Or, you know what I mean? Like, there was a moment where I was just like, because I'm just used to press. And then I remembered what I tell comics all the time, which is like, don't do networking. Don't try to get agents to come see you. Just keep your head down and do stand up and get great. And when you're great, I promise people will be talking about you, you know? But it was just so funny that I, like, all these, like, very rudimentary, embarrassing lessons I kind of had to learn over again. I was just laughing at myself. Usually in the bath, once I take a puff, I take a bath at night and I have a puff. And I think about the day and I, like, I feel more clear-headed. Like, I go, oh, God.
With everything going on with the pandemic, are you a person who goes, oh, I'll be back in the clubs once they open back up again? What do you think about that? What do you think about your stand-up career going forward?
Yeah, I'll always do stand-up. I mean, I can't wait to get back to stand-up. And I feel like, oh, I should adapt to these Zoom shows and stuff. And I've done it a couple times, but... you have to adapt. Like, and that's what comedy always finds a way, you know, and I believe that. But I really want it... I'm really looking forward to live when it's fully safe. Like, I just feel like, hang on 3 more months. We're going to have a vaccine.
You've had a hard COVID. In April, one of my teenage heroes and your friend Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, which is one of the best bands ever, if you have not heard them, you should, especially that first album, passed away, and he was working on a musical with you based on your memoir, Bedwetter. First of all, how are you doing? And secondly, what happens now with that work?
It had been 8 years and it was going up, you know, like, and it's a lot like my dad is like one of the main characters in it, not in real, you know, but like my, someone playing my dad, and he, you know, my dad's 83 and for years he's been like, how much longer do I have to stay alive for this thing? He finally bought tickets. He bought his flight, you know, it was cast, and Adam got me this sweet Airbnb in New York, and I moved March 10th. For 3 months to put up the show finally. And on the 12th, he came over to the Airbnb with Joshua Harmon, who I wrote the book part of the musical with, and Annie Kaufman, who was directing it. And we were just going to do a final, just like drinking wine, whatever. I don't drink, but you know, like, you know, just read through it just before rehearsal started and stuff. And we did that. And, ate pizza and, you know, I mean, I remember I had everyone wash their hands for 20 seconds before they came in, but it wasn't like, and then like 3 days later, he texted and was like, I think I have this. I have like a 105 degree temperature and I'm coughing. And we're like, oh my God. He's like, yeah, I think I have this. And then it was like 5 days in, he's like, I've had this for 5 days. I still can't get a test anywhere, but I know I have it. And it was like light, you know, like, ha ha, you know, like, oh my God, are you okay? Then he's like, you're not gonna believe this. I'm in the hospital with pneumonia from COVID. And we're like, oh my God, you know, but we're texting. It just didn't feel grave. And then the text stopped and he had been put on a ventilator. And his girlfriend, Alexis, kept us up to date. And for 3 days in a row, he had made little tiny improvements. And then April 1st, he just, I learned on the internet that he had passed away.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I'm just like not fucking with it. You know, my dad, I see him every week, at least once a week. And like, I'm just not going to bring something. I'm scared for me. I don't want to get it, you know, but it's like, I'm so excited about this vaccine.
So what happens with the, do you know what's going to happen with the play?
We're gonna do it. It's now supposed to be going up in June, but there's no way it'll be pushed again. But they're sticking with it. It's at the Atlantic Theater in New York, and thank goodness they're really sticking with it. They're standing by it because a lot of shows just they're just not gonna happen. Theater is brutal. I mean, it's like stand-up. They can't go back at 30% capacity. They barely survive at 100% capacity.
You did an NPR interview where you said that you have to keep your overhead low. You can't be a comedian and be funny and live a totally detached life where you don't do errands and stuff. I mean, so how does that work when you're like a super famous comedian? Because then how do you do that?
Because, I mean, when you're a comedian, it's not like... If people see you at you know, Albertsons, they're like, it's, you know, it's not like a, oh my God, that's Nicole Kidman. You know, it's like, it's like comedians are familiar. They're familial. They're like, people feel like they went to camp with you, you know, which is lovely and can be scary when it, you know, that's why I think I have a like deep fear of drunk people from just being like grabbed or like physically moved by someone else's brute strength, you know, like drunk. There's like a drunk strength, you know, take a picture with me. You know, like I just want, you know how you just want no trouble? Like, I just don't want any trouble.
Well, Sarah, I hope to talk to you again, but thank you for doing the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
My pleasure. I really like it. I was listening to a bunch of them.
Oh, well, cool. Cool.
And
good.
I really like the show a lot.
Sarah Silverman will be on the Netflix end-of-the-year comedy special Yearly Departed, hosted by Phoebe Robinson. And her new podcast is The Sarah Silverman Podcast.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Sarah Silverman and Ijeoma Oluwa.
Keep tweeting and Facebooking and Instagramming us your comments and questions using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. And please subscribe and tell your people to subscribe too.
And you can also leave us a message at 917-477-6525. 917-477-6525. We've got your messages and we will be responding to those that we need to respond to.
Kamau and I both have Netflix specials. You should watch them. We're both found on Instagram and Twitter at WKamauBell and at HariKundabolu. And, you know, use Google. You'll figure it out.
Also, please support the Georgia Senate runoff. Support John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. Go to gasenate.com to help us win those two very critical seats in Georgia. Not just for us, but also for Georgia.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
And me, Hari Kundabolu. The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing the music to the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Oh, I forgot to mention our Cyber Monday codes if you guys want to purchase any of our...
We don't have stuff.